I'm the operator with my pocket calculator.
Welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community here on WCOM LP Chapel Hill and Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer, and each week here on the program, we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle, one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research and development. You can email us at radioinvivo@earthlink.net, and you can access a full archive of all of our past programs at radioinvivo.net. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham. NESENT is a collaborative effort of Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and North Carolina State University, and is sponsored by the National Science Foundation. NESENT's mission is to facilitate broadly synthetic research to address fundamental questions in evolutionary biology by providing an environment for fertile interactions among scientists. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research. Since it was founded in 1989, the NCABR has been fulfilling its mission to promote public understanding and support for bioscience research and careers. To learn more about the benefits of bioscience for the future of North Carolina, visit NCABR's homepage, www.ncabr.org, and its clearinghouse of bioscience resources, www.aboutbioscience.org. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by Moorhead Planetarium and Science Center at UNC Chapel Hill. Moorhead's monthly Current Science Forum series presents expert speakers and lively discussions of today's science headlines. Moorhead Planetarium and Science Center is online at moorheadplanetarium.org. And last but not least, thanks to the personal contributions of its faculty, Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the Biomanufacturing Research Institute and Technology Enterprise, or BRITE, at North Carolina Central University. BRITE is one of the newest and most innovative biotechnology educational initiatives in the country, and it is the only formal biotech degree program offered by a North Carolina university. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank this terrific group of underwriters for their support. Well, today on Radio In Vivo, we are going to have a fertile interaction with a NESENT scientist. We actually traveled to the deep blue sea with marine biologist Dr. Craig McLean. Craig has done some groundbreaking work, and that is not easy to do in the ocean, I might add, in that field. And I promise that's almost the last pun you'll get. We will hear all about that work, particularly deep sea systems and the dynamics of food limitation on biological systems, as well as marine invertebrate biodiversity and body size. And all that will become clear as we speak with Craig. Craig is the Assistant Director of Science at the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center, NESENT, as you heard, one of our underwriters here on Radio In Vivo, and that's in Durham. When he is not engaged in oceanic expeditions, of which he has participated in dozens, from the Antarctic to the most remote regions of the Atlantic and Pacific. Craig is also a very skilled and prolific communicator as a scientist, as you will hear. He is the founder and editor of a very popular blog called Deep Sea News, and his popular writing has been featured in publications such as Cosmos, Science Illustrated, American Scientist, and Open Lab, the best science writing on the web. Craig received his PhD from UMass Boston and did postdoc stints at the University of New Mexico and the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute. He also serves as the Marine and Aquatic Science Section Editor for the online open access journal PLOS-1. Craig, we spent some time together at the Science Online conference recently, just a couple of weeks ago. So it's great to see you again and welcome you to Radio In Vivo.
Well, thank you very much for having me here this morning. It was a pleasure to see you again as well.
You know, I'd like to start with you, as I often do with guests who have chosen to specialize in a very particular scientific endeavor. What attracted you to marine biology, and specifically to deep sea marine biology?
Marine biology is a little vaguer for me. I remember just a point in my undergraduate career saying I wanted to do marine biology. I've always had a fascination with the water, even growing up. I enjoyed fishing with my father. Seemed to be attracted to, taking hikes near creeks, near lakes and things on that line. So I've always had a fascination with aquatic habitats.
Mm-hmm.
The deep sea thing came up sort of randomly. I had applied to do a summer research program with an instructor and doing coral reef fish counts all summer long on St. Croix. You just spend all summer on this beautiful tropical island, scuba diving.
Tough.
It's a rough job. And, of course, so did lots of other people apply for this position, and I didn't get it. And part of this program was to put down who your number two would be, mm-hmm. If you can work with the fish reef guy.
Right.
And my second choice was a deep sea biologist. And up to that point, I didn't know much about the deep sea. I wasn't even for sure if I knew what the deep sea was compared to other sea. And so he made me an offer to come work in his lab for the summer, and I did. And since that was sort of the seminal moment for me, really knowing that it was sort of a wide open habitat geographic terms, but also scientifically, there was a lot of work to still be done, and just fascinated. Then I actually asked this person if I could come back and be their PhD student, and so I went back and pursued my PhD with him as well.
I see. So then that was in Boston?
And that was at UMass Boston.
I see. Excellent. So you got to spend a lot of time in Boston as opposed to St. Croix.
As opposed to St. Croix, yeah, which has its pluses and minuses. The winter's a little tougher in Boston.
Indeed. Well, I'm a Boston native, so that doesn't sound too bad.
And, yeah, also growing up in the South and moving to New England was a bit of a cultural shock.
I can imagine. I did just the opposite. It's absolutely a culture shock. Well, here you are back in the South, though. So I kind of, before we dive into all your research activities, I wanted to get a sense of what you're up to right now, what brought you to NESENT, and what your duties are in your position as Assistant Director of Science. That sounds like a job for a landlubber.
It's not. I mean, the beautiful thing about NESENT is that it brings in evolutionary scientists from a variety of disciplines. We have people who are more into theoretical advancement. We have people who are interested in genes and populations, in a variety of different organisms and mice. And I sort of fit into that same mesh research wise.
Mm-hmm.
My actual position in NESENT is to sort of act as a liaison between the in-house scientific staff and the thousands of visiting scientists that we have every year. As well as the kinds of science we do at NESENT is driven by the scientific community through a proposal process. And so I oversee that program as well, oversee our postdoctoral program. And as well as we're very centered on actually making an impact in the scientific community with the things that we do. And so we're held to that by NSF, who funds us.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of my job is actually assessing our impact on the scientific community in a quantitative way and reporting those to this, both the scientific community, but back to the National Science Foundation as well.
I see. How do you do that?
Not easily. It's, you sort of get into these issues where you're trying to assess how do you know if you're making an impact? And some of that is looking at changes in the types of keywords people use in their manuscripts, to how much papers from NESENT are cited, to changes in citation rate, whether NESENT science goes in journals that authors don't typically publish in, if people who come to NESENT are more apt to collaborate with other scientists after they leave.
I see. So a lot of
different things.
A lot of different metrics at work. Okay, well, so with all of that keeping you, I'm sure, quite busy, are you still able to pursue your research activities and still able to get out on the water?
Most definitely. Yeah, I still keep up an active cruise schedule. Last year I went out twice to the Pacific on a couple different expeditions. I have cruises scheduled, research expeditions scheduled for this year as well.
Let's call them that, not cruises.
Cruises,
everybody
right.
Everybody will be really jealous if you talk about
I mean,
all
I get to do spend time on the sea, but there's work. Yeah.
Indeed.
We call them research cruises, but I think research expedition is probably a little bit more a valid name for it.
Indeed. It's not tourism.
No, it's not. Fun, but not tourism.
Okay. Well, it sounds like you kind of have the best of both worlds at this point, then.
I really do. I have a great... Nesson is a fantastic place to work. It's very intellectually stimulating. And, yeah, and then my research program is right where I want it to be at now. And you mentioned that I have this sort of science writing and sort of public outreach component to my science program that includes the blog, and that has gained a lot of popularity and a lot of credit with even my colleagues. So yeah, things are going very well.
Excellent. Well, let's talk about some of your research, which is just fascinating. As we've discussed, you specialize in the deep sea environment. I know you've helped to completely rewrite the book when it comes to our understanding of that environment, that it is anything but a wasteland when it comes to biological population.
That's very flattering. I don't know if I've rewritten the book, but there has, you know, starting in the 60s, there was a sort of revolution in deep sea science that sort of said, wait a minute, there's a lot of organisms down there, and they're a lot more diverse than what we'd ever anticipated they should be. And some deep sea biologists have even made claims that, you know, that deep sea diversity rivals that of a tropical rainforest. And, for example, if you take a sort of meter square of mud about the size of a coffee table, you would find 300 species within that single area. And that's extremely diverse. And so the conundrum of deep sea biology has been, how can an environment that is sort of very, very food limited, as well as sort of these other environmental extremes, support so many species within such a small area. And so a lot of my recent work has been focusing in on trying to understand that.
Right, because how deep are the waters we're talking about here?
So we typically define the deep sea as anything deeper than the continental shelf, which is about, the edge of that is about 200 meters, about 660 feet.
Okay.
So anything deeper than 200 meters, and the areas that I prefer to work at are the abyssal plains, which are usually at depths around 4,000 meters, about, you know, 12,000 feet or so.
Wow, that's pretty deep.
Yeah, it's pretty deep.
Well, what are the conditions like at those depths? You know, I understand there's no light at all.
There's absolutely no light. Light,
very little food.
Right. So the lack of light sort of precludes photosynthesis in the deep sea, and so there's no plant life, and that means that primary production of sort of carbon material does not occur in the deep sea except in these sort of specialized environments. And so most organisms rely upon food sinking from the surface waters that are produced by plankton, and so they rely on that, on the sort of flocculent and sort of the upper levels of the ocean to sink down, or at some cases, very large organisms like fish and whales and things like that, when they die, they'll sink to the deep sea floor.
Okay.
So that's the only source of carbon. And as you can imagine, very little, as things sort of eat away at that, as that those particles sink through the water column, by the time it actually arrives to the sea floor, it's both much less quantity than it originally started off as well as poor quality as well. And so only about 2 to 3%, and in some places maybe a max of 5% of the total amount of sort of carbon material that occurs at the ocean surface actually makes it to the deep sea floor.
So the food supply then is extremely limited.
Extremely limited. And a lot of my work has been trying to show what the consequences of that extreme food limitation are, both for biodiversity, but for the evolution of body size of organisms in the deep sea.
Right. So how is it, given that very limited food supply and very extreme conditions, no light, extreme pressures,
extreme pressure.
How is it that this remarkable biodiversity has arisen then?
I think it still remains a bit of a mystery.
Still looking for that.
I think we're still looking for the answer.
We'll have you on next year when you have the answer to that.
Yeah, I'm sure it'll only take me another year.
Right.
I think our sort of current thinking is that So the size of organisms we're talking about are very small. They're less than they're the size of a penny or smaller, typically the size of Abraham Lincoln's head on a penny.
Okay.
And so they perceive the environment much different, whereas we look at the abyssal plains and we see a very sort of flat, monotonous environment. At the scale that they interact with the environment, it's actually quite complex. There's, you know, minor divots, you know, bumps and little hills and things like that that they perceive. And those collect food material, as well as the sinking of the material from the surface anyway also falls very patchily across the floor.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so what you have is these little micro habitats that form. And when you know, so in a size, again, the size of a coffee table in that area, there may be dozens, if not, you know, hundreds of little micro habitats. And so each one of those habitats supports a different set of species.
Okay.
And that's sort of our current thinking about that. And of course,
There are also some areas that may be just adjacent that are pretty much barren, right?
That's right. There may be a really food limited patch right next to it that sees little to no species.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things you've really worked on is the predictive ability of that it seems to be actually pretty random, apparently.
Some of the early work that I've done has shown that if you take samples right next to one another about the size of these little micro habitats, that knowing what species are in one habitat doesn't predict what species are in the next one. And there's no correlation between patches right next to one another whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, if you're walking across a field and you look down, you see a bunch of plants, you know that if you walk 10 feet ahead, you're going to probably see the same set of, and so that doesn't really occur in the deep sea, at least not in the way that we've measured so far.
I see.
There might be a sort of spatial scale at which this occurs at, a certain distance that it occurs at, but we haven't figured that out yet.
I see. Okay. So how do you physically conduct these studies of the biodiversity in the deep sea? Is it all with remote operated vehicles?
A lot of my newer work, all remote operated vehicles, which are essentially robots on tethers back to the surface that are controlled at the surface by a pilot.
Mm-hmm.
And they have arms, and they're allowed, you know, and a high definition video that's brought back to the surface. And they're a wonderful tool to use because they don't have human occupants. They have much longer bottom times. They're safer. Unfortunately, they're also quite expensive to operate. For a ship, an ROV, it runs anywhere from $25,000 to $50,000 a day for usage. And so, you have to think very carefully about how you're going to utilize that time. In the past, the way that I've sampled, and before the advent of sort of remote operated vehicles, the way that most people sampled was by dropping pieces of equipment to the ocean floor, coring devices, or dragging things across the ocean floor to collect samples.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
which as you can imagine are not as precise. I mean, they're great for bringing up lots of samples, but knowing exactly where you sampled on the seafloor and trying to repetitively sample in the same location become quite problematic. And of course, there are some parts of the deep sea floor that you can't sample like that. You can't core rock, or if the bottom is very complex, then you can't drag a trawl over the bottom. And so submersibles, starting, you know, with the Alvin,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Out of Woods Hole, right?
Right. That was which they're coming up with. They're now decommissioning soon, I hear, and building a new one.
Okay.
With that sort of coming along in the 60s and the remote operated vehicles really coming into use in the 80s, they've really changed the way that we've done deep sea science. And as expected, the amount of information we know about the deep sea has exponentially increased over the last, you know, 20, 30 years.
As a result.
Right. And now we're sort of on, mm-hmm. we're on the brink of a sort of a new revolution in deep sea sciences with people starting to use autonomous underwater vehicles. So these are robots that are not tethered to the surface anymore, and they're programmed with a mission and sort of set loose. And as you can imagine, and then you sort of collect the robot later and download data, and that can be, you know, chemical data. They've been used for mapping the sea floor at really high resolutions. They've also been, you know, and now people are looking at equipping them with video and really being able to do these long sort of video transects across the seafloor.
Wow.
That and the other
almost like exploring Mars or something.
Exactly. And some of the technology is the same.
Okay.
The other thing that's come on are sort of these ocean observatory networks, which are basically you run power cables and Ethernet cables from the coast out across the continental shelf down into the deep sea, and then there's a hub, and then basically you and that hub has plugins, and basically you can plug in different pieces of equipment to that, whether they be cameras or small remote operated vehicles that tether back to that hub, and then basically the data is fed back to the, you know, back to your office via an Ethernet connection, and you can make manipulations of the equipment and change the experiments and things you're doing right from your office computer.
Oh, how cool is that?
Yeah, so there's been major NSF and NOAA initiatives to get these observatory networks off the ground. And I think, you know, there's lots of engineering sort of hurdles to overcome. But I think they're very promising for the future, especially for repetitive sort of monitoring of the same site over and over and over again, which we really lack for the deep sea.
Mm-hmm, but that's got to be an important factor.
Most definitely.
Mm-hmm. Well, Greg, I'd like to talk a little bit more about your research on body size. That's one of your kind of central pursuits, I know.
Yeah, it's sort of my pet theme.
Okay. Why is that such an important aspect to arriving at a larger understanding of the deep sea environment?
For me, I think the important thing to understand about an organism is that they're little machines. And the size of a machine tells you a lot about how that machine can work. And the size of a machine tells you how much energy it takes in and needs to create a certain amount of work or put forth a certain amount of effort. And body size is the same way for an organism. Every aspect of an organism's evolution and ecology is somehow influenced by body size. So, for example, we know that larger organisms require more energy than smaller organisms do, but they're more efficient at that.
Mm-hmm.
Per sort of unit mass of a larger organism, they require less energy than the same amount of mass of that a mouse would. And so, and it also tells you how much offspring that they, you know, knowing the size of an organism tells you how much offspring they can produce over the course of a year, how frequently they might do that, how they're going to interact with predators and prey, how they perceive the environment. And so understanding, so looking at what controls body size in effect lets you understand how these other ecological processes might be affected. And it's sort of a first step to understanding these systems. But it's also a very conspicuous and easily measured thing as well. And it sort of captures a person's imagination, including mine.
Mm-hmm,
And
it goes right back to your first internship measuring little snails.
Measuring lots of little snails. And that summer I measured thousands of little penny-sized snails to look at how size changed with depth. Depth.
So size does matter.
Size does matter.
Sorry.
At least for deep sea snails.
Indeed.
One of the most conspicuous parts of the deep sea is sort of these miniaturization and giganticism. We're all really familiar with sort of classic examples of giants, you know, like the giant squid.
Mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
There's other sort of ones that have become very popular in culture recently. The giant isopod, which is isopods are essentially like roly-polies. And even in shallow water, they don't get much larger than the size of a typical roly-poly on land. But in the deep sea, they get the size of your shoe or bigger. There are also giant sea spiders, which are not truly spiders. They're sort of in their own separate group. But in shallow water, they're the size of a quarter. And in the deep sea, they're the size of a dinner plate.
Oh, wow.
And so then on the other hand, it seems there are lots of organisms that get really, really small, including snails and clams and sea squirts. And so what the conundrum is been sort of what not only drives that miniaturization, but what drives the giganticism. They're two exact opposite patterns. And so some of that has been what we strive for is a sort of a single parsimonious hypothesis to explain everything. And that's really hard to come up with. And, but I think in the last few years, I think that I've sort of come up with an idea that simultaneously explains both of these types of patterns.
And I'm going to ask you about that in just a second, but I want to reintroduce you to our listeners. On Radio In Vivo today, we are talking with Craig McLean, who is Assistant Director of Science at the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center and is, as you've heard, a marine biologist. So, Craig, are you bringing us up to the so-called island rule?
I am bringing us right up to the island
rule. All right. Well, what is the island rule, and how does it apparently also apply to the deep sea environment?
Okay. So, the island rule is this idea that on terrestrial islands, so we're going to go out of the sea and we're going to go back onto land, that on islands that really weird things happen to body size. And the tendency is that larger organisms evolve towards smaller sizes and smaller organisms evolve towards larger sizes. And you probably know examples already. And this,
when I was reading this over, what struck me immediately was thinking about the tortoises on the Galapagos,
so,
or the Galapagos, little humans.
Right, Galapagos tortoises, Homo floresiensis, the new sort of species in the Homo genus, supposedly is supposed to be an example, although that seems to be contentious. Mm-hmm. There seems to be a bit of a debate about that.
Sure.
You know, things like the Madagascar hissing cockroach that, you know, get 4 or 5 inches in length, the ant-sized frog in the Seychelles, we also, the elephants, the miniature elephants that occurred on the Channel Islands as well as in the Mediterranean islands.
Mm-hmm.
A modern example is the key deer in the Florida Keys are quite diminutive compared to, say, of white-tailed deer.
Sure.
Across the south.
So these isolated environments have their own unique evolutionary pressures.
It appears to be, and they sort of have been, and because of that, you know, for the same reason they captured Darwin's attention, they continue to capture ecologists and evolutionary biologists' attention today because they have these sort of unique selection pressures. Now, which of those sort of have selected for these kind of trends in sizes sort of been up to debate. Some people have suggested, well, that these result from the idea that when an organism makes it to an island, usually there's not very many other things on the island.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's reduced competition, and that leads to these sort of increases in sizes or decreases in sizes. The other one is that not only would there be because there's fewer species on the island, that means less competition. There's probably also less predation.
Sure.
And then, of course, the other one that has been proposed is that islands are food limited, that because they're small, they don't support as much plant mass. And so there's less energy available on the island for organisms. And these size patterns are sort of a response to that. So these are this island rule is a very classic pattern. You typically hear about it in any undergraduate biology course, it's usually brought up. And and I'd heard about this for years, and when I started thinking more about body size evolution, it struck me that the sort of examples of these sort of size extremes on islands matched what I was seeing in the deep sea, sort of anecdotally. And so I worked with a colleague who studied evolution of size on islands and sort of proposed my idea to her that we should quantitatively test this. We should look for this sort of gradual gradate pattern in which smaller organisms get larger and larger organisms get smaller. And of course, to be able to do this, you need a very large data set.
Sure.
And it was such that a colleague of mine, Gary Rosenberg, had a very large data set of basically all snails that occurred in the Atlantic Ocean on the western side, both shallow water and deep sea. And so using his data set, we were actually able to test this and found a very similar pattern in deep sea snails, that, you know, this evolution of smaller things to larger sizes and larger things to smaller sizes. And of course, this brings us back to the original question, which is, what is it that the globe's smallest environments and the world's largest environment have in common? And if anything, competition and predation are probably higher in the deep sea because of the lack of food. There's those are likely to be much more intense. And so that the deep sea and the islands don't share that. But what they both share is this food limitation. And I think the reason, and so I proposed, not yet tested, but proposed it in this paper on this subject, that the reason for that is because larger organisms just require too much food in a food-limited environment. And so there is a real selection pressure for them to sort of get smaller.
Sure.
Smaller organisms, on the other hand, don't have fasting potential. They're not able to accumulate fat stores to withstand starvation. And in an environment like the deep sea, where food may be patchily distributed across the seafloor or may be patchy in the way that it occurs in time, you know, you may be a pulse in the spring, you may not get any more. Starvation resistance is really important. But not only that, if you're too small, the area over which you can look for food decreases as well. And so there's actually a selection for a slightly larger size. And what you see is this, as you get deeper and deeper into the deep sea, you get this convergence towards this kind of medium size, kind of a Goldilocks, you know, sort of the one in the middle kind of scenario.
So what are some examples that you've seen other than the snails, as you've documented?
So this convergence on size, the snail paper was sort of the first one to really explore this kind of avenue of thinking. And the only other group that I've seen this in is sharks, actually. And there was a paper that was published a few years ago in Proceedings of the National Academy of Science that showed that sharks didn't get any deeper than, say, 3,500 meters in the deep sea, and it's because they required too much food. And after that depth, food was such of low quality that they quantity that they couldn't really exist.
Mm-hmm.
And what they published in that paper was actually both the number of shark species with depth, and showed that really diminished after this. But they also published a plot that didn't seem to. That most people didn't notice, which I did, interested in size, which is that they really converged. That as you got deeper and deeper, sharks converged on a size that was sort of kind of in the middle.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Other than that, there's not been any studies to show this. I have a student and I are working now on looking at clams, and looking to see if they show a similar pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you have to keep. I think the thing that confounds all this is the idea that these different organisms require different amounts of energy based on what they do in the environment. You know, sharks are very energetically expensive, and we don't think of it, but snails actually are too. It takes a lot of energy to produce a shell, to carry that shell around all the time, as well as produce mucus to be able to move along, a mucus trail to be able to move along.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas
mm-hmm.
clams, they kind of just sit there. They're not energetically very demanding. And mm-hmm. so it may be that this sort of consequence of lower food may not hit them as hard as it does, say, sharks and snails.
Okay. Well, this whole thing is really looking at evolution in action, isn't it?
It's trying to.
Mm-hmm. That's neat. One thing that I wanted to ask you about, which... If it's a little off the wall, forgive me, but
that's okay.
Have you looked at the influence of fluid dynamics on body size?
It's something I've thought a lot about, but not specifically focused on. So, for example, one of the things is how viscosity, because of colder temperatures and increased pressure, would presumably go up. And what's the consequences of viscosity in pumping liquids through a circulatory system? What would the consequences of that be on an organism, the shape of the organism, as well as how their circulatory system is laid out, mm-hmm. and their overall size? No, I think it's a fascinating question, but not one that I've sort of started to explore.
I see.
Okay. Yeah, it has gotten as far as being notes and notebooks at this point.
Well, I'm a former guest of mine last year, I want to hook you up with.
Okay.
Over at UNC, who does look at that kind of thing and influence on body size, particularly among insects, but also among some marine creatures as
Excellent.
Well. Anyway, one thing that I wanted to ask you about, Craig, is have you been able to determine directly any impact on body size or other characteristics of these animals from anthropogenic pressures. Climate change, changes in the carbon levels, mining, fishing, those are the ones I saw most cited. But
Those are the major ones. The biggest threats now continue to be fishing, as well as mining activities, which are starting to increase as sort of precious metals have gained more value in the markets. The other things are obviously any sort of disruption of temperature, acidification, as well as food input, you know, changes to large-scale currents that may occur because of temperature changes. But no, there is no study that I know of or have conducted that sort of looks specifically at how those things would affect body size of deep sea organisms. I mean, it stands to reason that there will be an impact, especially if food gets in any way disrupted.
Well, will the data that you've been gathering about all that be of value in terms of establishing baselines for comparison as time goes on?
I hope so. I think the problem that we suffer from in deep sea biology, in deep sea sciences in general, is it's very, very hard to sample in a mechanism that would provide a sort of a long-term data set to look at changes. Now, there is an exception to this. Friends and colleagues have been studying this site called Station M that occurs, you know, in the deep sea, but off the California coast near Santa Barbara. Mm-hmm. And it's about 4,000 meters in depth. And they've been monitoring this site probably for 20 to 30 years, continuously measuring both what the organisms are doing on the sea floor, but as well as the number of what the actual food arriving to the deep sea floor is. And what they've found is that there's a lot of fluctuation yearly with that, depending on the dynamics on the sea floor are driven by the amount of food that comes into the system, and that shifted with El Nino cycles.
Interesting.
So in times when there, you know, during an El Nino cycle, when there was increased production and then production falls back off again during a La Nina cycle,
which we're in right now, I believe.
Right. Mm-hmm. Then, you know, that affects the organisms correspondingly on the deep sea floor. And that was important because was the first paper that conclusively showed that what happens on the deep sea floor is linked to what goes on at the surface, and that these environments are very connected to one another. And I think before that, we had this sort of a tendency to think of the deep sea as very remote and buffered against especially climatic change. And showing that climatic change can occur over such a tall, you know, that climatic change can affect the deep sea over decadal scales, I think, was a major finding. The only so my prediction would be that, you know, that these effects, that sort of climatic change and things like that, are definitely going to have an impact on the deep sea. The way that they impact on the deep sea, I think, is less known.
I know there's been a lot of progress in recent years characterizing some of these extreme environments in the deep sea, the hot vents and those things, and there's been a whole biology of extremophiles.
Right.
How does that fit in with everything you've been describing thus far?
So the hydrothermal vents, so these are the areas that you're talking about, are sort of areas where primary production is fueled by chemosynthetic reactions. So basically, out of these vent sites, sulfur and methane and will be sort of brought out, as well as a variety of other very toxic chemicals. And the organisms use those to sort of drive carbon production. And most of the organisms there have a chemosynthetic bacteria that sort of live within them. Some of the worms actually have specialized organs that hold those bacteria within them. And those bacteria take that sulfur, and use that as actually in the electron transport chain. And they take the methane or carbon dioxide, and they turn that into a usable carbon, a carbon sugar that the organism then, the worm itself or the snail or the clams, then sort of harvests.
Mm-hmm. So they kind of eat these chemicals in their
pretty much. And so those And what you see in these environments is because they're essentially living in their food, or the sort of primary components of their food, mm-hmm. then they operate differently than other deep sea habitats that are food limited. The number of organisms there is, you know, exponentially higher than what you see on the surrounding sort of abyssal plains that receive very little food.
I see. That's
and so the evolution of body size, the diversity, their trajectories there look much different. In fact, hydrothermal vent species in general are quite larger than as you would expect them to be when you're essentially living in a buffet.
Well, that is an interesting finding. Is that something you have studied yourself? Or?
No, I have the tendency to study the less charismatic sort of mud flats that sort of encompass the rest of the deep sea.
The snails and clams.
And snails and clams. Too flashy, and I seem to shy away from it, I guess. The hydrothermal – no, so I have not done hydrothermal vent or methane seep work.
I see.
The news study that I'm working on with my student looking at sort of the evolution of size and clams does include, because clams are a very prominent organism at both methane seeps and hydrothermal vents, will include that component to really track how they've changed.
I see. Well, Craig, I wanted to ask you about, and you kind of touched on this a minute ago, but I'd like to get you to perhaps elaborate about how the types of findings that you've been describing about the deep sea environment affect our understanding, our macro understanding of the larger environment. You say that there actually recently has come out that there really is a relationship there.
A relationship between?
Between the the larger environment as a whole.
Sure.
And this particular micro environment.
Right. So, I mean, I think the thing that I've always strived to do, and I mean, even you mentioned that I did a stint at the University of New Mexico, and that was not actually with a deep sea group or a marine group whatsoever. I wondered about that. That was, I got a lot of questions about what a marine biologist was doing in the desert. That was with actually a terrestrial ecology group that has been at the forefront of a lot of really cool and exciting findings in the last, 10 to 20 years relating how body size relates to a variety of other processes. And so when I think about deep sea systems, and one aspect I am interested in sort of understanding what goes on in the deep sea, but I'm also interested about what that can tell us about other environments as well. And I think using the deep sea as a model system, really understand how food, if you want to understand a sort of a process, understanding it at extreme tells you how it, tells you a lot about the process. And so and the deep sea, understanding how extreme food limitation controls these aspects of biodiversity and body size, then may begin to help shed light on how food gradients of food affect these things in other systems.
I see. So you're kind of collapsing the variables a little bit.
I'm trying to.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And adding a bunch of new ones sometimes,
yeah,
unintentionally.
I imagine so, yeah. Is it the kind of thing that the more you look at it, the more complex it gets?
I don't know if the more complex it gets, definitely the more I look at it, the more questions I have.
Okay.
It has become a bit trite, but it's no less true, is the idea, when a scientist answers one question, 20 more come up in its place. And that always seems to be the case.
Absolutely. Well, I know that you've spent most of your time studying deep sea environments, but your work has not been limited to just the deep sea, and I wanted to ask you about the research you've done on so-called seamounts or undersea mountains. I understand those are just a fascinating environment in and of themselves, and why is that so interesting?
So seamounts are basically any sort of submerged mountain that rises off the bottom by at least, 3,000 feet. They're different than the background environment in one that they're all of volcanic origin, and so they're usually dominated by sort of rocky, hard volcanic substrates,
mm-hmm.
and that in itself makes them much different than the sort of flat, muddy plains of the deep sea. And so the organisms you find on there are much different, and they're usually dominated by deep water corals and sponges, and those can get densities large enough that they sort of begin to look like reefs. You know, there's these dense meadows of sponges and corals. And so I got interested in them because they were they struck me as being much different than the background. And hard sort of volcanic substrates and hard substrates in general in the deep sea are not very well characterized. And so it was kind of a new avenue. But I had originally thought that these underwater mountains, much like on mountains are on land, that for some organisms, mountains serve as kind of a pseudo island. That if your population is at the top of a mountain, it's very hard for you to get to disperse to the next mountain. There's not very much gene flow between those two, and those two populations have become isolated.
Mm-hmm.
And I originally thought that something like that might be working on seamounts as well. And so this sort of island-like system in the deep sea struck me as a very sort of interesting avenue to test a lot of different things. And then, unfortunately, after looking, they don't appear to be isolated whatsoever. That marine organisms seem to have amazing larval dispersal sort of potential that really links even very distant populations. And so, but that being said, just a lot of the seamount work for me is very descriptive because we know so little about them. Just, you know, how different can two sort of seamounts be from one another? How does the topography of the seamount sort of affect what the kinds of organisms you see on there?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then last year I started building on this project to look at collaborating with geologists who can date sort of under lava flows that occur in these spreading zones along the seafloor. And they can dating these different lava flows from, and the ones that we were studying from 1,000 years up to 2 or 3 years old, looking at the kinds of organisms that occur on each one of those flows and tells you a little bit about how quickly organisms can sort of colonize new habitat.
I see. Well, it's been interesting to hear about the fact that conclusions you've reached is these are not, as you put it, islands, that they're very rich and very diverse
mm-hmm.
Habitats.
And very well, yeah, and the seamounts are very well connected to one another. You know, they mm-hmm. The seamounts share species with sort of the continental margin environments where other hard, so for example, hard substrates and canyons. So yeah, that was not what I had expected originally.
Well, that's half the fun, right?
That's half the fun.
Well, speaking of half the fun, there's a lot of fun yet to come, I'm sure, Craig. So what are some of the remaining questions that you would like to answer about particularly, obviously, deep sea biodiversity, body size, or anything else that's on your plate?
So I think one of the things, so we talked about how the island rule applies to the deep sea, and I think one of the things that I'm turning my attention to now is understanding how the energetic, so there's the strength of that relationship, how much size change you get from smaller things going to larger or larger things coming to smaller. How much of that is affected by the energetic demands of the organisms themselves? And so bivalves, like I mentioned earlier, that require much less energy, my prediction is that they're going to show much less of a gradient than, say, much less of a pattern than we saw in snails and sharks. And then turning from then sort of clams and clams to, and oysters and things to other groups that have more energetic requirements. You know, are they going to show much stronger gradients? And I think that's mm-hmm. a really strong test of whether this is food driven or not.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So that's one aspect. The other, continuing on the seamount work as well. I think the other big thing for me coming up is looking at how changes in the species over entire oceans, how much of that is it relates to how the environment changes, specifically the food availability. So in areas of the ocean, say the equatorial Pacific, that receive a lot of food, does that we know that those areas have the tendency to have more species, but do they have a different kind? Do they have a different set of species than areas that, that occur, say, in, under the gyres where food is very limited?
Sure.
So understanding how much of their turnover in species across oceans is related to this sort of variation in food supply.
Now what about the dead zones we hear so much about these days? Do those apply all the way into deep sea?
Oh, most definitely. If it's dead on the – if there's little – you know, sort of phytoplankton production at the surface, then there's probably little making it to the deep. And little is known about the sort of abyssal sea flora under those. I've started – one of the things I'd like to do in the next, you know, sort of 5 to 10 years is sort of take an expedition to the South Pacific gyre, which there was a paper published a few years ago showing that from geologists showing that that was sort of a bare zone, that there's very little material arriving to the sea floor in that area. Mm-hmm. And so the kind of organisms that sort of – that are adapted to that area that can survive there, there are organisms at all, I mean, maybe it pushes it to such an extreme that life – macroscopic life is not available. I mean, there will always be bacteria and stuff. And understanding that, I think, is really going to be a big sort of on my agenda for the next few years.
Well, we'll have you back when you start doing some of those expeditions. It sounds like it'll be definitely worth hearing about. One thing I wanted to ask you about the deep sea environment that you've been describing, are there any fish at that depth?
Oh, most definitely. Lots of fish.
Okay, good. Because we've been talking about clams and snails and things like that.
And
do they reflect this variance in body size, this island rule you've been describing?
I don't think that's really known. I mean, there have been authors that show that they do some of the patterns that we see with depth. So as you increase depth, you increase you decrease the amount of food available. One, because you increase distance from productive coastal zones, but also because that there's more water in which things can sort of refeed on that material sinking down. And it's been shown that there's been several studies showing fish show these sort of prominent depth body size patterns, which would suggest that they are affected by the food availability that other organisms are. And but it's important to keep in mind that deep sea fish are not like shallow water fish in some aspects. They're much longer lived because it's colder water. The reproduction is sort of slowed down. They don't produce as many offspring. Their densities are much lower. So now, as we're starting to get fisheries focusing on deeper and deeper species, those are likely to – I don't think we can actually fish deep water species. I don't think that there's a way that we can maintain both the sort of fisheries take and keep healthy populations. They're just not geared for that.
Like they wouldn't be abundant enough to be.
Well, they're not worth just the not effort. Abundant, but they can't replenish their stocks as quickly as, say, some shallow water species do.
Are you ever able to bring any of those species up in your expeditions in your sampling?
Not typically. I mean, I have colleagues who do focus. Jeff Drazen does a lot of work on at the University of Hawaii, does a lot of work on deep sea fish and their physiology. And he's actually really developed this really interesting apparatus that allows him to actually live capture a fish at depth and then bring it to the surface in a pressure chamber, in which then he can measure aspects of its physiology. And so,
neat.
Which is a technological feat that I cannot even imagine, but
really?
But
so
impressive nonetheless.
In a hyperbaric chamber.
Yeah, pretty much.
Wow. Neat. Well, Craig, I don't want to let our time run out, which it's about to, without having a chance to talk about some of your communication activities, which I know are an important part of what you do and which are very cool. Tell us a little bit about your phenomenally successful blog called Deep Sea News.
Sure. It's probably not coincidence that I started writing Deep Sea News when I was in the desert and away from the ocean a bit. And I sort of began just sort of making little posts about new research and stuff on my personal sort of research website. Mm-hmm. And that became very hard to keep up with. It's not easy to edit a web page like that. And then a friend of mine at the university suggested, oh, we should start a blog, to which I responded, what's a blog? And then after about an hour tutorial, I kind of got it and started up my first sort of blogger blog and started from there. And I was actually amazed that after a while, you know, within a few months, I was getting, you know, about 100 visitors a day. And I thought, wow, there's 100 people on the web that actually want to both read what I have to say, but also are interested in the deep sea.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there for a year and invited a deep water coral expert, Peter Etnoyer, to join me, who has recently left after he took on a new job that wasn't going to give him the time to sort of keep up with this. But we were invited to Science Blogs, went from there to Discovery Channel for a while, then sort of went back out on our own again because we felt we really wanted to develop without the constraints of sort of being with a part of a group, to really develop it out into something we wanted to see. So it has been really successful. We get about a couple thousand people a day visiting the website, and have sort of other ocean bloggers, so to speak, kind of look to us, I think, a bit. Because we've been around for a long time.
Become the central focus of that field. Right?
Unintentionally, I think. Yes, in part.
Mm-hmm. So it would be remiss of me not to let you pass along the URL.
Oh, it's simply deepseanews, all one word, .com.
That's easy.
That's easy.
Absolutely. So why do you seem to devote a pretty significant portion of your time to the blog and the popular writing we were talking about earlier and the speaking that you do as mm-hmm. well. Why is that important at this point?
That's a good question. And I've struggled a lot with why exactly it is that I do this. I mean, I think at a personal level, I just find outreach a very important part. I think it started off when I started getting involved in blogging more, it was because I felt a lot of what the media was covering about the deep sea was not the kinds of things that I thought were really cool and interesting. Then some of the new research that I saw that was having major impacts on our fields never really relayed to the public.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought I could really provide a mechanism. I could really be the person to do that. That was one aspect. And, you know, I think my wife had made a statement sort of earlier on that, you know, people want to conserve what they know and what they love. And I, although I don't really talk specifically about a lot of conservation issues on the blog, my general thinking is that if I can get enough people interested and excited about the deep sea, that there'll be much more interest in conserving it.
Sure.
And so I think those two aspects, and I think it's in part, you know, we learned as scientists that part of our role is communicators, and we typically think of that as communicating our science to other scientists. But I think an equally important part of that is communicating it directly to the public ourselves. And so, it's been an important component of my science program in general. A lot of the questions I've been asked on the blog, or I've used it as sort of have sort of made their way into my research, and a lot, you know, I sort of use it as a writing lab for papers and for new ideas and things along that line. It's kind of a test area, so to speak.
Okay.
And one of passion.
Indeed. Well, you know, I certainly applaud you for those efforts. It would be great if more scientists thought the way that you do about communication and outreach.
I think younger scientists now are putting a lot more emphasis on this. I see a lot of the sort of old opinion that we sort of being removed from the public,
mm-hmm.
you know, is not our responsibility to sort of communicate. I think that sort of thinking has winnowed.
Right.
And I think a lot of that has been because, so, you know, most scientists, a lot of scientists receive their funding from either NIH or NSF, and my funding comes typically from NSF.
And that's part of their agenda.
And part of their agenda, you know, a significant...
Greg, we're flat out of time.
Okay.
I got to stop you. Sorry about that. And thanks so much for being on.
Thank you very much again for having me.
And we will be back soon with some more great guests on Radio In Vivo. Join us next time.